ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. Innovation is a byword for success. It's been a key driver of growth and productivity, so more output from the same input. And it can generate wealth, Silicon Valley being the prime example. Today on the show, something Silicon Valley isn't so good at, spreading the wealth generated by all that innovation. And it's not alone in this. Many of the world's most innovative cities and regions are highly unequal. But some places, some countries, do better. So where and how? That's exactly what's explored by Neil Lee in Innovation for the Masses. Neil's a professor of economic geography at the London School of Economics. Neil, what got you started on this?
So it's kind of personal to me because, so I grew up in Oxford, which is a sort of, you probably know it from the university, it's a small town in England, and Oxford's had something of a high-tech boom, right? So over the last 30 years or so, we've seen sort of spin-outs and we've seen sort of new companies produce sort of highly innovative things. But one thing which has sort of always struck me is that none of my friends growing up seem to have benefited that much from it. So, you know, the place is producing, you know, great, you know, amazing inventions, but that doesn't seem to be sort of translating to sort of jobs for the sort of average person. In fact, for some of them, it's had sort of bad consequences because house prices have risen. They can no longer afford to live here. The type of jobs you can get are often sort of, you know, if you're not sort of doing, you know, superstar scientist type stuff, the type of jobs you can get aren't always very good. And because of that, some of them had to move. So for me, you know, I started working on the book when I came on sabbatical to my hometown and I saw, you know, what had happened to a lot of my friends.
It's that kind of reminder, isn't it, that innovation, which is so important to most economies, actually, to most successful ones, to wealthy nations, but it's not enough. It's not enough to just have this innovation if it only goes to a small group of people.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, you know, you can't do without innovation. So the innovation is the foundation of most successful economies, basically. You know, it's very hard to be a rich country without doing things better, commercializing new products, all of these things which are innovation. But like you say, there's a danger that if you do it, you end up with this sort of model where you end up with sort of bifurcated labor markets, people who do very well and people who don't. So actually one of the key arguments of the book really is that it's the other things you do alongside it which really matter, the other institutions you put in, the things you do to think about the people who are not necessarily going to be the star scientists, but the people who could and should be benefiting.
Yeah, and actually one of the stories you tell pretty early in the book is about your great-grandfather, Henry Lee, because he's a kind of embodiment of some of this, at least.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is sort of family history, but it is, you know, essentially my great-grandfather grew up in a small town in the sort of north of England, and he worked for a manufacturing company, and he also taught locally. And he taught people the skills which he was using in the manufacturing company. And this is, you know, you start thinking about this. And for me in the UK, this is like a sort of, you know, this is history. But actually that sort of like spiral of sort of vocational education where you have people who are teaching sort of advanced stuff and you have people who are sort of in, you know, in the local community in which he lives, that sort of stuff, they still have it in some parts of the world. They have much stronger tradition of sort of applied research. So it's not just people doing sort of blue sky research and sort of nice colleges. It's much more about people sort of doing stuff, which is, you know, he was not a great inventor, but he was doing stuff which was commercially useful and he was benefiting from it. And that's one of those things which really helps ensure that, you know, when you do have innovation, the benefits are broadly shared.
Yeah. And the other things that it kind of shows that, and you show, I think, is that innovation doesn't have to be that blue sky stuff you talk about. It doesn't have to be inventing a new gene editing technology or coming up with a new molecule or designing a new chip. It can actually be not at the cutting edge and still have huge value.
Yeah, you know, this is again a key message of the book. So when we think about innovation, we often think about sort of Google, Facebook, the sort of Silicon Valley sort of firms, which are, you know, which are doing things which are really sort of completely game-changing, massively sort of reshaping the world in which we live. But actually, you know, most innovation is much more, it's much smaller than that. It's much more sort of incremental, and it can be sort of small changes to sort of production processes, small changes in the way that you work. And actually this sort of innovation, and often, you know, you think about the sort of diffusion of new technologies, the diffusion of innovations from elsewhere, that's often where the sort of economic gains can be made, particularly in countries like the UK where I'm from. And, you know, you can see that this is something which policymakers often don't really think about. They think about innovation as being just the world leading stuff, but it's this sort of second tier of innovation about diffusion, about adaptation, which really matters.
Well, let's talk about that first tier stuff, because this is the thing I think that the media in particular, which I'm part of, popular culture, if you think about films, and especially films and TV, and politicians as well, that's where they go when you say innovation. And you touched on Silicon Valley, but in some ways, innovation only does so much in Silicon Valley. It does a lot, but it doesn't, I suppose, get the benefits of it to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, so no politician wants to go and do a sort of, you know, photo shoot at a local company and go, this company has gone from mediocre to pretty good. You know, no one wants to do that. But actually, that's the sort of thing which really matters for our economy. Particularly in a lot of countries, they have a lot of firms where there's sort of low-hanging fruit still to be picked. You know, yesterday I was in Scotland and I was talking to people about companies there where they sort of bought an iPad to do something with their production processes and they just couldn't be bothered to get it to use. You know, simple sort of things like that, where there could be sort of either new technology which was introduced from somewhere else could be used, or simple things, you know, small process innovations to their sort of manufacturing processes, which could really help them out. But it's quite a difficult message to sell for politicians. You know, it's much better to go and stand by some sort of shiny new research lab and say, this is the sort of world-beating stuff. It's much harder to say, actually, it's these small incremental improvements in the sort of average firm, which really matter.
Mm. And politicians love that idea of Silicon Valley, but it's a staggeringly unequal place, isn't it?
Yeah, so Silicon Valley's, I mean, famous for this, right? So to some extent, I mean, you can sort of divide, you can think about inequality as being like, there is sort of good inequality in that people who do good things can, you know, do impressive things should, you know, in my view, certainly sort of get some of the rewards from that. But the problem is when you have this sort of inequality, which sort of comes sort of locked in Silicon Valley, one of the things we see is sort of big companies, which then sort of essentially can protect themselves against new entrants into their markets. And you get the similar things with sort of, you know, rich people can basically sort of protect themselves from the sort of the creative destruction in the world outside, which is really sort of important. So this notion is that there should be some sort of churn in sort of society and in life. And actually, you know, Silicon Valley is one of those examples where there's been world-leading innovation, which has been hugely important for all of our lives. You know, I'm speaking to you now on an iPhone. But at the same time, we need to balance that off. There's a trade-off there. We need to make sure the benefits of that new technology are sort of shared with workers in the Bay Area. And traditionally, they haven't been. Traditionally, it's been a place which is very, very unequal. And it's a place where you have a lot of people doing well and a lot of people doing, you know, what are often quite tough jobs to sort of essentially service the needs of those people.
Yeah. But because of the, I suppose, the eye-catching stuff, the headline-grabbing stuff, I think there are, and you will know, a staggering number of attempts being made to replicate Silicon Valley all around the world.
I mean, there's a huge number. I've been sort of in the Gulf, and you have sort of very intelligent policymakers in the Gulf who are sort of telling you, and they're saying, we're going to be, you know, creating a new Silicon Valley. And you know that they don't have a, you know, hope in hell, because there's only one Silicon Valley. And, you know, it sort of came about by sort of almost random chance. I know that they're not going to do it. They know they're not going to do it. But it's just become this sort of model which people reach for. And part of the argument for the book is actually there are places which do this better. There are places which sort of manage to do world-leading innovations which change our lives, but which do it in a way where the benefits are more evenly shared.
This is The Money. You're with Richard Ady. And my guest today is Neil Lee, who's a professor of economic geography at the London School of Economics. We're talking about some of the ideas that he explores in his book, Innovation for the Masses, and we will get to the masses bit in a minute. But I just want to talk a bit more about how we understand innovation and what it means, Neil, because it's so much more messy, I think. It doesn't really lend itself to an easy definition.
No, that's quite right. I mean, it's a messy, complicated process. So most people think about innovation and they actually think about invention. So if I invent, you know, famous Australian invention would be Wi-Fi, right? It's a good example because it's something which was invented in Australia. So that's the invention, but the innovation is the sort of application or the commercial application of that in, you know, wherever it is. So I've got no idea if the people who invented Wi-Fi made much money out of it. I suspect probably a bit, but not fully reflecting its value. And actually, then there's a sort of second order thing, which is that, you know, that new innovation is then used in a range of other things. It makes other things possible. So you end up with this sort of combinatorial, it's called, innovation, where the fact you have Wi-Fi enables, you know, me to be speaking to you on a sort of iPhone, or, you know, people to do work in coffee shop. And it has these sort of knock-on effects. Mm. We tend to think about the sort of single inventor, but actually innovation is much more about sort of people putting stuff which other people have done together into new commercial uses and exploiting that.
Well, we'll talk now about, I suppose, the big key examples you've studied as places where the benefits of innovation are getting shared a bit better. Now, what is interesting, before we get into the examples themselves, is that you're not holding them up as utopias. Indeed, they all have problems, in particular when it comes to things like inequality, gender inequality, and migrant inequality. So why did you pick those four?
So first of all, I mean, each of them has a sort of slightly different policy message. So, I mean, there's no perfect place. One of the places I studied was Sweden, right, which people often say is like a Nordic utopia. And clearly it's not. You know, it's a social spending's, you know, been falling. They've been having struggling, as you say, with sort of inequality between sort of migrants and the sort of Swedish population. And so you have all these sort of problems with these places. But first of all, each of them manages to somehow combine some element of relative equality with being highly innovative. So the four countries I sort of study are Sweden, Switzerland, Austria, and Taiwan. And each of them has sort of some nice policy messages. They show us that actually you can be highly innovative in a way which does share the benefits. Not perfectly, as I've said, but, you know, as an academic, I have to have some sort of nuance in there. But they do tell us stuff which is important and useful.
All right, well, let's look at Switzerland. Always been an outlier. It's been neutral for a long time. I think there'll be people listening now who will think, well, Switzerland, watches and chocolates and banking, but very wealthy. How does a country that wealthy be held up as having distributed income across its population?
Yeah, so Switzerland is a really interesting case. So there's a lot of rich people in Switzerland, right? There's a lot of people who are, you know, global elite type rich people. But actually, they have this sort of institutional structure where it's probably, you know, I would argue it's probably the best place in the world to be a worker. So 22% of Swiss national income goes to the bottom 50%. That doesn't sound like too much, but that's a lot more than it is in Australia, where it's 16%, or the US, where it's 10%. And the way it does this is through a combination of sort of institutions, which mean that they combine that sort of leading edge innovation. So it's got the biggest Google HQ outside of the United States. So it's got that sort of tech innovation, but it's also got sort of small firms doing sort of innovative stuff around the different cantons. And it's got places like Basel. So Basel is like one of the pharmaceutical, you know, hubs of the world. Like by patenting measures, it's probably more innovative per capita than Silicon Valley. The key thing is, I mean, you go there and you see that there is a difference, because this structure has created good jobs. You know, it's not been the sort of place where you just see a sort of set of star scientists. You have an education system, an economic system, which is good at creating good jobs for people who would not necessarily be the star scientists. And that's why it's such an interesting place.
Yeah, yeah. And well, I think the other thing that most people won't realize is how innovative it is. It's incredibly innovative.
Yeah, I mean, you should think about sort of some of the big pharmaceutical companies like Roche, for example. It's got some of the sort of fine engineering in some of the early iPhones, for example, came out of Switzerland. It's got, you know, world-leading universities. So it's got some of the best universities outside of the United States. It's, you know, I have to be careful saying this as a Brit, because we're very proud of Oxford and Cambridge, but ETH in Zurich is probably a sort of better institution than either of those, at least on some of the sort of league tables. The world Intellectual Property Organization regularly ranks it as the world's most innovative country, and for good reason.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't just do one thing well, it does a lot well.
Now, I think we should, while we're in the region, we should talk about its neighbour, Austria. I kind of had an idea that Switzerland was innovative. I would not have guessed that Austria is. And we'll come back to the equality bit in a moment, but how is Austria innovative?
It's innovative in a very different way to Switzerland. So Switzerland's like a sort of all-rounder. It has the tech stuff and it has some sort of manufacturing stuff. Whereas Austria is interesting because it's 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it was not seen as like a highly innovative place. But it's had the largest increase in R&D of any country in the OECD apart from South Korea. And basically, most of this R&D increase has gone into sort of big companies out in sort of non-high-tech sectors. So some of this is you know, steel companies. There's a very big steel company, which is very important. But they're also good at producing products, which we wouldn't see as being sort of high tech, such as wood. Like they have some sort of amazingly yes. sort of high tech ways of treating wood. And, you know, I saw agricultural products, which were sort of essentially applying high technology to very low tech parts of the agricultural, you know, food chain. So they're good at that sort of thing. And actually, it scores very badly on some measures like venture capital. So venture capital, very popular way of sort of funding tech firms. Every single policymaker I spoke to in Austria said, we don't have enough venture capital. But then, you know, I'm from the UK and they're like 20% richer than we are. And we've got loads of venture capital. So they must be getting something right. So it's a really interesting example of essentially an economy which is adapted.
Yeah. So other proxies for innovation, apart from venture capital, are things like broadband penetration, share of university graduates. It's not very good at either of those things.
No. And this is something which, you know, they worry about, right? So first of all, I mean, when you talk about university graduates, it matters less whether you are a graduate, whether you go to a university. What really matters is the skills, you know, the skills that you develop. And they have a skills system where people who don't go to university develop the skills they need to sort of participate in parts of the sort of innovation process. So they really show that actually you can do well even if you're, you know, it's a small country, but you can do well even if you don't follow the sort of Silicon Valley model. And they have a couple of tech firms, but really, you know, nothing particularly exciting. The question for Austria is how things are going to look in 20 years' time, right? Because, you know, they have these sort of this industry which is doing well now, but the question is, does the economy need to adapt?
So their strength is this vocational education and training. So you do have this cohort of people who are highly productive, mid-skill, if we could put it that way, and technical workers, and that's vital to it.
Yeah, that's absolutely vital. And those are the sort of jobs which we're often missing somewhere like the United Kingdom, sometimes missing in parts of the United States as well. It's the good jobs for this sort of average worker. And the sort of Austrian model and the Swiss model is good at creating this sort of jobs because they have this vocational education system and they have, you know, labor market policy, which sort of basically makes sure that companies create that sort of job. And the result is that you end up with these highly innovative firms which create good jobs for people who aren't just the star scientists.
But I want to say, I feel a lot of these good jobs are for Austrian blokes. And inequality is like more than one thing. It's always unfair. But it also makes no economic sense because it means you're not getting the most out of the people you could be getting the most from. But Austria's gender inequality and their migrant inequality, they're both pretty staggering.
Yeah, they're staggering and they're sort of indefensible and they're deeply rooted in the history of these places, right? You know, you talk to sort of very successful Swiss academics who was sort of still sort of railing against some of these issues and rightly so. And the other thing which I would say, right, is that, you know, these places, they could do so much better if they did somehow include, you know, these groups who are willing and keen and highly skilled and, you know, want to be part of the sort of innovation economy, if I can put it like that. So it's kind of one of the things which is sort of holding them back, I would argue.
Yeah. So Austria's story is kind of communitarian negotiation culture, labour market institutions you've mentioned, and that skills and training and industrial policy. All right, let's move to the other side of the world, to Taiwan. Very different place. And as you conclude, it went from growth and innovation, then to inequality. But let's start with what spurred the innovation.
Yeah, so Taiwan's a case of sort of, it's an interesting story, right? Because it's so unique in sort of, you know, it's in such a unique part of the world. And even within the sort of Asian tigers, it's a sort of unique story because of its sort of history with China. So the key story about Taiwan is that it sort of developed rapidly and it developed rapidly. One of the main features of that sort of development process was innovation and sort of moving up the value chain from sort of relatively less high value products and sort of getting better and better at certain things. So we reached a stage where now they are just very, very good at semiconductors as a sort of economic strategy, but also, you know, frankly, as sort of a political one as well. So they had this like long process of essentially effective industrial policy with strong focus on applied research, strong focus on you know, education and skills to make sure that they have the sort of workers who are going to be sort of able to work in these sectors. And at least for the early phase of their development, it was that sort of educational development which seemed to be holding back inequality, because jobs were being created. And as the first people sort of move into those jobs, that was sort of reducing inequality. It's only more recently that things seem to have got quite a lot worse.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the tricks they pulled off earlier on in their curve, if I can put it that way, is they got that rapid economic growth alongside equity. They didn't generate growing inequality as they kind of went up the wealth scale.
Yeah, quite. Whereas now, things are looking much worse. So they had a period which was called the growth with equity period, where people were sort of holding them up as this sort of example. And actually, when I started doing my field work, I remember the first couple of interviews I did with Taiwanese people, I said, so it must be great to be in this sort of like highly equal place. And they'd sort of look at me, they're very polite. They'd look at me and they'd be like, are you sure? Are you sure this is right? Actually, in the end, I ended up doing more data analysis, starting to look at some more research. Some Taiwanese researchers published some work. And actually, I discovered while writing this book that picture was no longer true. And I think that was no surprise to sort of Taiwanese people, but it was still something which was sort of picked up in the literature. And it's a shame. You know, they're struggling with intergenerational equity. There is a big issue, particularly people, you know, younger people who are squeezed out of the housing market, had to work very hard for their education, but can't get the jobs in the sort of tech sector. And there's a big divide now between the people who get jobs in the tech sector and the people who don't. So they're facing some sort of problems. It was a big feature of the recent election campaign.
So what went wrong, Neil? Because as you say, they have lost what they had, and yet in a way the country's richer than ever.
Well, this is part of my sort of argument in the book about sort of the problem with when you do the sort of really frontier innovation, like it does move things forward, and there is always going to be a sort of a period when the innovation is outpacing the inequality, I would say. You know, you're going to have a few firms who are able to sort of benefit from the rents from innovation, as we call them, the sort of benefits from innovation. And it's often only later that you sort of develop the sort of institutions and the structures which allow the benefits to be sort of shared more broadly. And I guess we sort of hope that that's going to be the case in Taiwan.
This time on The Money, we are talking about that great engine of economic growth, innovation, and how its effects and the wealth it generates is often not distributed very evenly, and what can be done about it. Some countries have really had a go at this in different ways. And this stuff's all documented in a book, Innovation for the Masses, which is by Neil Lee, who's a professor at the LSE in London. He's our guest. I want to ask you about Sweden, which is the last example you write about. And you mentioned it before. We do, especially from perhaps this side of the world, often see it as this sort of Nordic superpower, which has been good at things like welfare state and helping the people with the most disadvantage. And it became very successful in high tech with Stockholm at the centre of it. And I think that's one of the kind of paradoxes, because one doesn't think of a place with a big welfare state as being innovative as well.
Yeah, so this is one of the common arguments you'll hear, both in sort of university seminar rooms, but also sort of often sort of right-wing politicians, is they'll say that you cannot have a large state and succeed in the sort of, you know, high-tech digital innovation, which is sort of driving much of the world economy. Now, Sweden shows that this, you know, the relationship is a lot more complicated than that, because it is this archetypal Nordic model country where the state does a lot of work. State still redistributes quite a lot. So in the Swiss case, which I was talking about earlier, the state doesn't do that much to redistribute, you know, income from rich to poor. Whereas the Swedish model is much more a redistributed model. So money, you know, people pay high taxes and the taxes go through good public services, but they also get sort of redistributed. And Sweden's interesting because it has this sort of like, it's probably the European country, you know, maybe apart from sort of my own, which has had the most success in digital tech. So companies like Spotify or, you know, Klarna, these are sort of big world-leading companies in their field, which are doing things which are in digital tech. And actually, so when I went to sort of investigate what was going on there, the thing, key thing which people kept saying was actually, you may pay higher taxes there, but actually, you know, you will benefit from the public services and you'll benefit from the sort of wider ambience of the place. The fact that there aren't sort of quite so many sort of homeless people, the fact that the sort of, you know, the schools are slightly better and all that sort of stuff. Again, it's not perfect. There's big issues with the sort of housing market, big issues with immigration. But what was striking to me was just how much the sort of role of the state in terms of serving these sort of basic functions seemed to matter for the sort of tech firms who are locating there.
Yeah. One of the things you identify which I didn't know, is that per capita the country has more kind of rapidly scaling so-called unicorn firms and tech billionaires than America does.
Yeah, I think it's got almost double the number of tech billionaires that they have in the United States per capita. You know, so these are people like the founders of Spotify, for example, founders of other sort of big Swedish companies. And the interesting thing is that they often stick around. They often stick around and reinvest their money locally and sort of help create that sort of second wave of innovators in the area by offering them advice, offering them money, you know, offering them sort of inspiration. Yeah. So actually they serve a sort of long-term role in sort of building up a sort of, for want of a better word, and a sort of ecosystem in Stockholm.
Now, well, yeah, we're talking about Stockholm. Has the benefits of this kind of innovation-driven entrepreneurship, have they been spread throughout the country?
I think it's a great question. I think a lot of the sort of digital tech stuff is happening in Stockholm, but there is some sort of interesting stuff happening in other parts of Sweden as well. So battery factories up in the far north, for example, taking advantage of some of the sort of resources there. That's a sort of type of thing which they're doing. But the tech stuff tends to be focused in Stockholm. But the interesting thing about Stockholm, so the OECD sort of say that Stockholm, despite having this sort of high tech, so if you look at, you know, Silicon Valley, it's like one of the most unequal places in North America, whereas Stockholm is actually more equal, according to the OECD, than other places like Malmo, some of the other sort of big Swedish cities.
So what's the lesson from Sweden then?
For me, the lesson is that you can have a big state and at the same time success in digital tech, provided the big state is a sort of highly effective one and provided these other sort of things are in place. So, you know, you end up in Sweden with very high, so they have very high inequality in terms of wealth, and they have very high inequality in terms of, you know, as you've mentioned, the sort of number of billionaires. But generally, income inequality is relatively low, and that doesn't seem to be hindering the growth of their sort of successful tech sector.
The thing, as I kind of think about these four countries that you've identified, Neil, is that there's obviously been a role in all of them for policy and decision-making. A lot of this stuff is cultural. A lot of it comes out of the things that the people in the country value and how they have traditionally worked together. So how much can we take the Swedish example or the Austrian example or the Taiwanese example before it went a bit wrong and say, well, we can use that here?
Well, so, I mean, you're absolutely right that a lot of it's sort of cultural, and you're absolutely right that we need to be very careful about sort of, you know, policy learning from places which are very different to our own. But policymakers are using the Silicon Valley example, which is also cultural and also sort of very different. So, you know, there is precedent for using examples from elsewhere. And my argument really is that you need to take the sort of top line of this, right? You know, try and think about what exactly they're doing at a sort of quite an abstract level, so that then you can start to think about, you know, how you might reinvent your own country, your own city, your own sort of region in a way which really benefits, means that the innovation economy is benefiting workers.
It has to stick with the culture, though, doesn't it? If you're trying to make a country into something that culturally it's really not, it probably won't work.
You know, culture matters for these things. It matters a huge amount for entrepreneurship, and it definitely matters for innovation. So, yeah, you have to be very careful about saying, right, we're just going to pick up the Swedish model and sort of apply it in some part of the United Kingdom or sort of, you know, Queensland or somewhere like that. You have to be very careful about that.
Yeah. Neil, it's a fascinating book. Lots of things that I didn't know. And in many ways, I think it will be eye-opening if it's read in the right places. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Neil Lee is the author of Innovation for the Masses, How to Share the Benefits of the High-Tech Economy. That's it for now. The money comes to you from Gadigal Land, Sydney. It's produced by Whitney Fitzsimmons. Our sound engineer, Simon Branthwaite. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.